the whole office. It's Ms. Mkhwebane. Today is the 26th of August, 2022. I want to welcome the members here at M46, members on the virtual platform, the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, her legal team led by Advocate Mpofu, evidence leaders, Advocates Bauer and Advocates Mayosi, members of the media, our entire support staff, members of the public who are with us in their various platforms. You all welcome to our inquiry session today, it being the Friday. I want to, as I proceed, perhaps before I invite Advocate Bauer and Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, to keep my promise with Advocate Mpofu about the brief issues you wanted to place on record, that we yesterday, I recognize you, Advocate Mpofu.
Yes, thank you so much, Honorable Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everyone. Chair, remember I had said there were three issues. The other two were minor issues. It was the one about the witness list and the duration of the cross-examination. So that's, we managed to deal with those yesterday. The one that I had said would take a bit longer is the one that was outstanding. thank you, Chair. Chair, I appeal to you to just be patient with me because I have to map this. This may culminate into something quite serious about these proceedings. Chairperson, let me just give you a bit of background. This matter that I'm going to talk about concerns the judgment that came out of the Constitutional Court about 2 days ago and its implications for this committee and more particularly the reaction thereto by the National Assembly and the committee. So I'm just flagging where I'm going with this, so that you're not wondering as I'm giving you the background what it's all about. Okay, now, Chair, I'll give a very brief factual and legal background or backdrop to the issues that I'm going to raise. Very briefly, I gave some of this background on the first day of our proceedings here, so I won't go to town about some of the details. I'll just give a high-level summary. I think everybody by now knows that last year the Western Cape High Court found the rules of the National Assembly that bring us here to be unconstitutional in two respects. One was the issue of legal representation, we've spoken about that, and the second one was the issue of the inclusion of a judge in the independent panel, whether or not that was in breach of the something.
Let's suppose, okay. Both, so that because I can see their time is always when we start, they bring tea. So I'm going to have to fix that. Okay. They must do it before we start. Now they are closing you off with that kind of a walk because you're on the platform.
Oh, I
it's
see.
Better when it's some.
Yes.
But when you understand it, it's not good. But proceed.
Okay. So can I continue or start again?
Continue.
Just continue. Thank you. All right. Now, I think, Chair, yes, the two issues in respect of which the rules of this committee were found to be, or rather the rules of the National Assembly were found to be unconstitutional, was the issue of the participation of the legal representative in the committee and the involvement of a judge in the inclusion of a judge in the independent panel, whether that was in breach of the separation of powers or not. Then fast forward, so that's what happened in the Western Cape High Court. Then Parliament and the DA appealed in the Constitutional Court direct appeal, which was had I think sometime in November or so last year. As we now know, that on the 4th of February, the Constitutional Court delivered this judgment, and it dismissed the appeal by Parliament on the question of legal representation, which is why I'm talking to you now. and it upheld the appeal on the separation of powers issue, in other words, the inclusion of a judge. On the 22nd of February, this committee then met, and against the backdrop of the Constitutional Court judgment, and decided that it would continue with its work, to use a neutral term. And what then happened, Chair, is a series of matters that became relevant to the Constitutional Court judgment that I'm going to talk about. We know by now that on the 10th of March, the Speaker wrote to the President, and that culminated in the President issuing or initiating a suspension process. And again, those issues are well known to everyone here and even the public. So I won't go too much into that. But suffice to say that around about the end of March, the president, we made appeals for this committee to suspend its activities pending that litigation. And every time that this committee decided not to do that. And so by the end of March, if you fast forward to that, the position was as follows. The president had agreed to put a, for lack of a better word, moratorium on the suspension process, but the committee had not agreed to follow suit. And therefore, solely because of the attitude of the committee, we then had to go to court. Fast forward again, the parties agreed, Chair, to have the matter heard on the 26th and 27th of April. It was an urgent application, but there was as it happens in complex matters, negotiated with many parties. We negotiated a date where everyone was available. Unfortunately, the matter that really then put a spanner in the works occurred on the 24th of April. The counsel for the National Assembly and for this committee, Advocate Breitenbach, received an SMS from a certain Mr. Abram G, indicating that he had it, quote, on good authority, unquote, that the judgment would be coming the following week and the public protector's application would be dismissed. That application, Chair, was in respect of the second leg of the Concord judgment to do with the judge, where there was a rescission application in respect of that. And so Mr. And that was an issue in the litigation that I referred to. Because what we were saying basically to you, to the parliament, is that stop continuing the matter because it's subject to care. It's continuing before the Constitutional Court, among other things. So basically what Mr. Abramji was trying to do was to say to your counsel and that of parliament, don't worry, the subject care point is going to be moot because next week the judgment is coming in your favor on good authority. Now, this resulted, to cut a long story short, in the parties, including parliament and the, and this committee, agreeing that the matter should be postponed and no longer be heard on the 26th and 27th of April, which it's not a mistake. We were actually going to be sitting on Freedom Day. That's how urgent the matter was. Pending the parties approaching the Chief Justice to find, to investigate this unprecedented occurrence. That happened. The postponement was granted by agreement, and we jointly wrote a letter to the Chief Justice, and the Chief Justice a few days later spoke on SABC and indicated that indeed he was going to investigate this. It was a matter of concern and so on. The public protector, for her part, conducted an investigation in terms of Section 6 of the Public Protector Act, which revealed and issued a report within a couple of weeks, which revealed alarming facts, including that one of the Constitutional Court judges had had about 18 telephone calls between him and the and Mr. Abramji, the sender of the SMS, up to the 22nd of April, which is 2 days before the judgment. And it also revealed that, contrary to what we had been told, Mr. Abramji had sent earlier an earlier SMS, at least, to Advocate Breitenbach, citing a judge who was his friend or something about public office, the holding of chairmanships in public office and in NGOs and that kind of thing, state-aligned institutions or commissions. Anyway, so that report was raised even more alarm. Then on the 3rd of June, Shepperson, the Chief Justice issued a media statement stating that, he was finalizing his investigation. And I put the emphasis on the word he, because he said he is finalizing his investigation. In other words, the public must not be alarmed at the delay and the because he'll be finalizing his investigation. Well and good. And then completely out of the blue, on the 17th of June, the Chief Justice then released a report of an investigation which it was said had been led by retired Judge Mbati. This was, to put it mildly, bizarre at two fundamental levels. One, it was the first time in South Africa, or at least in anywhere that I know of, that we get an investigation report by a person whose identity and appointment is only revealed at the stage of the report, not at the stage of the appointment or the conduct of the investigation. This is completely unheard of, Chairperson, I can assure you. Then secondly, the content of the report also did something quite strange, because it purported to overturn the public protector's report. We know that the same constitutional court said in the EFF Nkandla report that a public protector's report can only be overturned by a court of law, which is how it should be, not by some investigation which is revealed at its tail end. Anyway, the public protector had instituted an application, Chair, in the constitutional court to deal with this, and I'm now coming close to the issue that is here. That application, Chairperson, sorry, Chair. That application has been mischievously dubbed as a rescission of a rescission, you know, by those who want to mock the application or to portray us as mad black people. But the application was really primarily not about that. That application primarily was about basically the public protector asking humbly that in the light of the alleged leak and corruption, possible corruption of anyone who might have leaked a court judgment before it is published, the Constitutional Court should not then issue that judgment until the investigation, more or less. That was the main issue. And the Chief Justice, Raymond Zondo, was cited as a respondent in that application. And so I'm not going to waste your time, but just to tell you what the prayer one of that notice of motion said, like, declaring the conduct of the Chief Justice in one, authorizing the release of the judgment or order dated 6 May 2022 in the rescission application prior to the outcome of the investigation. In two, complying with the improper request of the Speaker for the urgent disposal of the rescission application. And three, failing on or refusing to respond to the applicant's letter dated 3 May 2022 to be invalid, unconstitutional in terms of Section 172(1)(a), alternatively Section 38 of the Constitution. And then came this issue about the rescission. But it doesn't suit the media narrative to portray the application for what it is. So it's called by what it is not. But that's fine. That's who I used to that. Cut a long story short, the Chief Justice and other respondents responded, put an affidavit, again, which has never been published by any media house. And we responded to the Chief Justice and other respondents, which was also never published. But the 24th, it stamped the 24th, that's Wednesday. On Wednesday, the 24th, while we were sitting here, the outcome of that application for the declarator of the unconstitutionality of releasing that judgment in the light, or rather, without investigating the alleged corruption came out. Sorry. And the court said that it concluded that the application should be dismissed as No case had been made after the decision, which, as I said, was not the main relief sought. The applicant ought to pay the cost in her personal capacity, as this application constitutes an abuse of process of court. Nothing said about the declarator, which was the main relief. Anyway, be that as it may, the issue really that we want to address, is then what happened thereafter against that background. The first thing that happened is that literally within hours of this, while we were all sitting here, the Speaker of the National Assembly and the chairperson of the Section 194 committee, yourself, chairperson, presumably on behalf of this committee, filed a notice of application in terms of Uniform Rule 65E of the rules of the court for those who don't know what that is. It's an application, it's not an unusual application, it's an application where you want to bring, normally you are only allowed 3 affidavits in a court application, filing affidavit, answering affidavit, and a replying affidavit. So if for some reason you want to file an extra affidavit, a 4th or 5th or whatever application affidavit, then you have to apply in terms of this rule. So this one was for an order permitting the Speaker of the National Assembly and the chairperson of this committee to file an affidavit of one Mr. Leon Manuel of the state attorney, basically giving this judgment of the Constitutional Court or ruling to the Western Cape High Court, obviously in a bid to influence the outcome of the pending judgment in the urgent application that we have brought in the Western Cape High Court about, mainly about the suspension, but also about the goings on in this committee. Must not be heard to be saying that there's something untoward per se with invoking that rule. I'm simply saying that was the obvious intention. And the fact that it was done, as I say, within hours, I don't even know when the chairperson, they must have consulted him over the phone or something, because we were all sitting here and then we came out and found this. Fine. We will have to deal with that. We have a view about the relevance of this judgment to those proceedings, but we'll deal with that in court. Because our view was that the sub judice rule did not only apply to the Constitutional Court application, but also to the High Court application itself, because the matter was sub judice, because it was in the Constitutional Court, but also because it's in the High Court. So the fact that one of those two things has been resolved is neither here nor there, really. But as I say, that's an issue that will be discussed in that court. The last issue then, Chair, which brings me to the point I'm going to make, is that the spokesperson of Parliament, including this committee, I presume, then issued a media statement and did a series of interviews welcoming this punishment of the public protector with a personal cost order for abusing the court by merely asking that a judgment issued under these mysterious circumstances should have been withheld until the investigation was done. And that the court, which was implicated, just to put it mildly, in this, needed to account, or the Chief Justice to account for what may or may not have happened. And so let me illustrate the situation like this. This is the exact situation that the public protector was complaining about. Imagine if there's a body that we all know here called Umalusi, which is in charge of examinations, of matric examinations. So imagine if Umalusi, if there was a leakage of an exam paper from Umalusi, and somebody says, I've got it on good authority that Umalusi is going to set this paper and set it around the country. And then the public protector investigates that and finds that there is some smoke in it. But Umalusi itself then appoints one of its own, does an investigation, doesn't tell anyone, and then tells us that there's a report of Mr. So-and-so or Ms. So-and-so. And if someone found that a bit strange, or a government department did that, I'm sure everyone would understand that. But here, it meant that the public protector, how dare she even ask questions? She should have just suffered in silence when someone says, there is a judgment about you that is going to come next week. She should have known her place and kept quiet. But that's a story for another day. What we are complaining about, Chair, is your involvement in all this. Firstly, the end of that of the speaker, but the speaker is not here. In the submission of that abrupt application, which, as we say, is intended wrongly, but that's another story, to influence the outcome of the other application. But more importantly, in the triumphalist statements that were made about welcoming the personal cost order against the public protector, we find that to be completely not in line with the role of this committee, to the extent that you are speaking for the committee or yourself, if you are speaking for yourself, because we are in the middle of a process here which requires for all of us to try and dignify it and try at the very least to pretend that it is fair and reasonable. It's very clear, I think now, anyone who's been watching this, it's clear that that may just be a pipe dream, but I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to see it through.
I'm now urging you to round up, please.
Yes, I'm just the usual 2 minutes, Chair, that is left. So that's effectively the complaint we put. It may or may not culminate in an application for your recusal or removal, but it's something that we'd like you to consider, not necessarily to deal with now, but impromptu, but if that's what you want, you can do that. But maybe at our next sitting, or by correspondence or whatever, you can address us. But our instructions are to raise it very sharply and to either at least get an explanation or something, or why it was done that way, in case we're getting the whole thing wrongly. And subject to that explanation, we will then decide what to do next. But it's something of serious concern, Chair, because otherwise we can't be sitting here wasting the public's money, just going through the motions with something that is far from what it was intended to be, which is fair, reasonable, neutral, and respectful of the public protector and all the other participants and the public. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu.
That took exactly 30 minutes, Chair.
I will say that. Don't worry, I'm going there. We started at 10. You asked for my patience. I hope I've given it.
You have to.
To 30 minutes, which affects the time I'm giving to the evidence leader, because if I had the intention to have her up until lunch, it's clearly not going to happen with that 30 minutes that I'm going to have to utilize for her. But let me thank you, because the intention here was for you to place on record what you have now defined as a complaint. It is not going to be for discussion. I've noted the complaint you've placed, because I have to respect the time we've set. It is for the witness who's on the platform for 30 minutes now, we've not started with. I will make a ruling on this matter. But I don't want to take the time of the evidence lead and the witness to get into that point. So you would have, in the 30 minutes, placed on record a journey, and at the end, the actual complaint. I obviously am a very mindful person on time, so I would have even timed how much time you gave to the complaint and the journey. That's how I work. But it is well received.
Thank you.
And noted, and the ruling will be made. Thank you very much, Advocate Booth.
Thank you, sir.
I now recognize Advocate Bauer.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everybody. This morning's witness is Mr. Tembankosi Muntusitoli. And Mr. Sitoli is on the platform.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, Advocate Bauer.
Can I just add, before we swear Mr. Sitoli in, two things. Mr. Sitoli is, as you will hear, the manager of legal services. There is two components to his evidence. Today he will deal with matters that arise in the context of his job as prescribed broadly within his affidavit. But there is a component of it that we will leave over for next week, where he will join the senior man, the acting senior manager legal services. And there we will put before the committee, and I'm hoping, we don't have the final numbers yet, which is why we're not doing it today. I'm hoping that I can get an agreement with Mr. Mpofu on it, and we can deal with it quickly, is the number of judgments and orders, the number of reports issued, reviewed and set aside, and the costs, the legal costs out of the Office of the Public Protector. And so I would beg an indulgence today that when it comes to questioning Mr. Sitoli, that we try and get through the evidence we'd like to get through today, and that issues arising in relation to that stand over for when he comes back to deal with those issues with the senior manager, legal services, and that everything else gets dealt with today.
Okay. Thank you for that. I now recognize Ms. Fatima Ibrahim to do the preliminaries.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Sitoli, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, I can hear you.
Thank you. Mr. Sitoli, you have been invited, subject to the provisions of Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act of 2004, to appear before this committee as a witness and to answer questions in respect of the committee's inquiry into the removal of the public protector, Advocate Mukwebane. Please be informed that by law, you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of this inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside of Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware further that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. Mr. Sithole, I'm now going to ask you to either take an oath or to affirm that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. You may choose either the oath or affirmation. Which do you prefer?
Affirmation.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask you to please raise your right hand and repeat after me? I solemnly affirm.
I solemnly affirm.
That the evidence I shall give.
That the evidence I shall give.
Shall be the truth.
Shall be the truth.
The whole truth.
The whole truth.
And nothing but the truth.
And nothing but the truth.
Thank you, sir. Chairperson, the witness is now duly sworn in.
Thank you, Ms. Ibrahim. Welcome, Mr. Sithole.
Morning, morning, Chair, and morning to you members.
Thank you. I now hand over to Advocate Bauer.
Good morning, Mr. Sithole.
Morning, morning, Advocate Bauer.
Mr. Sithole, we're going to follow a format where I'm going to put briefly a background to you. We're going to deal with some general principles, and then we're going to go to some documentation. And I don't understand this to be in dispute, so I'm going to just run through it quickly, and you can just confirm it at the end. You commenced your traineeship at the Good Governance and Integrity Unit at the PPSA in 2013. You then went to do articles. You returned in 2017 as an investigator in the private office. You then transferred to legal services you became the acting manager legal services from 1 April 2019, and you were then permanently appointed in that position after it was advertised with effect from 1 August 2020. You had, when they were there, reported to the senior manager's legal services, and you currently report to the acting senior manager legal services. Would that be a correct summation of your first few paragraphs?
That is correct, Chair. And just to add that the Mr. Advocate Van der Merwe is now the senior manager, not acting.
Ah, okay. And you're an admitted attorney?
Yes.
And you, as part of your duties as manager legal services, you used to attend to management and operational meetings in paragraph 8, certain administrative requirements such as bid adjudication, financial misconduct and security committee, and you didn't sit on task team or task register or dashboard or those things since you became part of legal services, but you did attend to quality assurance and full bench meetings, correct?
Correct.
So before we deal with any particular issue, because you occupied a unique position in the organization, let me take you through some general propositions, which I think we've touched on many weeks ago, but maybe we can just contextualize it again. You would accept that the public protector, and we'll just call it the PPU for short, has a constitutional requirement or that the PP performs responsibilities, bearing in mind that there's a constitutional requirement that holds the PP to high standards of independence and, for that matter, impartiality.
Correct.
And one would expect the same from those who are in the employ of the PP's office when it comes to conducting investigations and searching for the truth, but they do so independently and impartially.
Correct.
And that as the PP must perform responsibilities and duties without fear, favor, or prejudice, so too one would expect the employees of the PP's office to do so. Correct?
Correct.
Right. And it is important because the office must engender confidence in the public, in the PP, in the office of the PP, that it operates in an independent, impartial manner that respects the rule of law and the constitution. Correct?
Correct.
And it must guard against any actual bias and any perceived bias. Would you agree?
Correct. Correct.
And so those from whom the PP chooses to seek legal advice from must be able to provide the office and the PP with objective, independent, competent, lawful legal advice that allows the office to best fulfill its responsibilities. Would you agree with that?
Correct.
And would you agree that in dealing with matters of natural justice, such as fairness, giving a hearing, audi alteram partem, not being a judge in your own cause, are important principles that the PP must uphold? And when I say the PP, I mean the office of the PP as well. Would you agree?
Agreed.
And so that fairness must permeate the work of the office of the PP and the PP. And politics should play no part in the discharging of the obligations. Would you agree with that?
Agreed.
And that would have to be the case irrespective of the complainant. Correct?
Correct.
It must reflect in the contents of the reports. Would you agree? Sorry,
agreed.
Sorry, you're nodding your head, but there's a record, so I must remember that you must answer. But maybe I must say to you correct so that you know.
Yes.
And that when reports are issued, politics shouldn't play a part in it as well. Correct?
Correct.
And in the way that the office and the public protector deals with its complainants, all complainants must feel that the complaints are dealt with properly, seriously, and that one complainant should not feel that their complaint is worth less or more than any other complainant. Would you agree with that?
Agreed.
And so there must be no perception that your office plays favorites. Do you agree?
Agreed.
Right. In other words, you must operate beyond reproach.
Agreed.
Agree?
Agreed.
And so I want to use an analogy. You must draw within the lines of the law and you must scrupulously in doing your work do so within the law. Correct?
Correct.
And you and I and others who are officers of the court, we have an obligation to be frank and honest in making oral and written representations to courts more so than any other ordinary person. And it is expected of us to act with good faith, with honesty, and make full disclosures to courts. Would you agree with that?
Agreed.
Would you also accept that as contemplated in section 165(4) of the Constitution, the public protector, I'm going to, it's the provision on courts, Mr. Sitoli. Let me read it to you so that we don't. But 165 of the Constitution is the one headed judicial authority. And the proposition I'm putting to you is that as organs of state, through legislative and other measures, must assist and protect the courts to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility, and effectiveness of the courts, the public protector should do that as well. Would you agree?
Agreed.
And under section 165(5), that an order or decision issued by a court binds all persons to whom and organs of state to which it applies. Agreed?
Correct.
And so you would also, as a lawyer, understand and accept that when the reports are taken on review, what is under scrutiny is the process through which the decisions contained in those reports have been reached. In other words, in reaching the conclusions therein, that it is rational, complies with the rules of natural justice, and other applicable precepts of law, such as jurisdiction, etc., and that it meets the principles of legality. Do you agree?
Correct.
And any lawyer would know that if it falls on that process, and no matter how right you may think you are on the facts, or even how wrong you may be on the facts, you don't get out of the starting blocks if you haven't painted between the lines and complied with the law. Would you agree with that?
Correct. Great.
And as a lawyer, you would know there is a material difference between what the court of first instance considers in a review and what the ambit of the powers of an appeal court could be, would be when it comes to considering an appeal of a decision of a review court. Agreed?
Great.
Chairperson. Just pause, Advocate Bauer. Advocate Mbofu. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, no, I just want, I'm not quite sure what's happening now. I wanted to check if this witness is called as an expert or whether he is being called, as a factual witness to give evidence on specific issues. But if he's called as an expert, then we should have been notified so that we can prepare in our witness list an expert that may become, because it won't be make any difference for us to then, otherwise I'll be forced to give my own expertise, which I'm not allowed to do. I should rather do that via a witness, yeah. When I cross-examine him, I just wanted clarity, number one. But now that we're there, so that I don't interrupt again, to maybe specifically tell us in respect of which of the charges this witness is being called.
Okay, Advocate Bauer.
I didn't interrupt Mr. Mpofu when he repeatedly put legal propositions to witnesses who came to testify, prefaced him as a lawyer, and ask them to agree or disagree with legal propositions.
So?
It has been going on. Oh, no. Let me finish, please. I have endeavored not to interrupt. I'm coming to a point as to, I'm putting to the witness, and I want to get his understanding of how he understands the context in which he operates, which is what I'm doing. If I wanted him to give evidence as an expert, I would have told Advocate Mpofu that he's here as an expert. So at the moment, Mr. Sotoli is a lawyer, as Ms. Mohaladi was a lawyer when Mr. Mpofu put legal propositions to her. Mr. Kakana was a lawyer, as Mr. Mpofu put legal propositions to them and asked him to explain on their understanding of the law, and as he did to Mr. Samuel and his understanding of what the crime was. I thought that there's a context in which he wanted to do his cross-examination, and I'd like to be allowed to have the leeway to do the same with the witness. As far as the charges on which Mr. Sotoli is coming to give evidence, he's going to talk to the charges. He's not talking to four, so he's talking to the other charges.
Three.
1, 2, and 3. He has an involvement in the Frieda matter, and he has an involvement in the litigation in the Frieda matter, and he has a peripheral knowledge of the Gordon matter as well that comes in. I think it's evident, so there's a cross of things that he comes in. There's other things that he needs to clarify in respect of what other witnesses have given evidence on that he would have knowledge about and that we would need to deal with. And there's an importance on a range of issues that covers other evidence.
Okay, thank you. I hope that helps a little bit, both.
Yes, it does, Chair. If I may just say, I'm not being difficult. I just really wanted to understand so that I know how to respond. There's a vast difference between putting questions under cross-examination and calling a witness, which is what Advocate Bauer is doing. I'm sure she knows that. So under cross-examination, I have leeway. I could ask about the weather, quite frankly. But Yeah, but I wouldn't call a witness here to tell us about the weather, for example. But anyway, be that as it may, I just needed that clarity. Because if the witness is going to give us, if he's been called for his expertise, because I wasn't sure if maybe we're going to move to other material or whether this was just kind of warm-up stuff. But so that's as far as the first issue is concerned, Chaplain. So I maintain that the if the committee is intended to rely on him as an expert, in other words, as a legal expert, that then we should have been told. But as far as the second point issue about the ambit of his evidence, Chaplain, I'm covered by what Advocate Bauer is saying, and I obviously have looked at the statement, so I know that it does touch on FREDE and FSP and all the other things. I would have thought that it also reference would be made to 100.3, or can't remember what it is in the actual motion, the one that talks about fruitless expenditure and legal costs. Okay, that's in charge three. So, but I'm not making an issue about the ambit issue. I'm just making an issue about the expert evidence.
Okay. Thank you. Switch off, Advocate Mbofa. Your mic. Switch off your mic.
Oh, sorry.
Mr. Mbofa, when I say he's not talking about charge four, I mean he's not talking about the
HR issues.
The HR issues specifically. And I did preface before he came on that when it came to legal costs, we're going to deal with it next week. So I'm not going to deal with that as a whole, although there are aspects of legal costs that we will touch on individually, but not as a composite basis.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Advocate Mbofu. You can switch on your mic. I think I get the point about the contextual grounding of where you want to go, and I'm sure you would not take another 30 minutes as well to that. Please proceed.
Right. So we before we were interrupted, Mr. Satoli, I had put the proposition to you just so that we go one step back, because I can't remember whether you answered it or not. But you would know that, as we all would, that there is a material difference between when a court of first instance, what a court of first instance considered in a review, and the ambit of the powers of an appeal court when it comes to considering an appeal from a review court. Correct?
Correct.
All right. And so to decide whether a court of review is right or wrong on appeal, that appeal court would need to look at it through the prism of what the review court had regard to when it came to its conclusion. Would you agree with that?
Correct.
And so this might sound trite, but just so that we contextualize it, you would also know when it comes to judicial reviews, it would be an application. It is supported by affidavits, and the courts consider the contents of those affidavits. Correct?
Correct.
And a court has no more before it than what is contained in those affidavits. Correct?
Correct.
And so you can't expect the court. So let me give you an example, Mr. Satoli. If you don't tell the court that Mr. Muntu Satoli can play soccer in an affidavit, right? Instead, you say to the court, I'm pondering what the meaning of soccer is all about. And you cannot fault the court if it can't make a finding that Mr. Muntu Satoli can play soccer on application. Would you agree with that in principle?
Correct, yes, in principle, yes.
Right. And if you take the review court on appeal, because it made no finding that Mr. Muntu Satoli can play soccer, because you didn't tell the review court that you could do so, it matters little that you now decide for the first time to tell the appeal court about it, when that appeal court has to determine whether the review court was correct in its conclusions or not. Do you agree with that as a principle?
Agreed.
And you can't say to the appeal court, but I have a picture of my soccer boots. And because I have a picture of my soccer boots, the review court should have concluded that I can play soccer. Would you agree?
Correct.
Now, please, I don't interrupt, Mr.
Okay. Please pause, Advocate Bauer. You might not know what he wants to raise.
Yeah.
Advocate Mbofu?
Chairperson, well, firstly, it's not true that she has interrupted me so many times. But I apologize. The point I want to raise really is Advocate Bauer should know better. That's why I was asking the question. If the witness is an expert, then of course she can ask all these nice things. But if the witness is a factual witness, then what he says about his understanding of this or the other is completely irrelevant. Could be asking anyone in the street whether they think this is a review or an appeal or whatever. So what? That kind of line of questioning can only be justified if the person is being presented as an expert. In other words, they know something that they have expertise which is beyond the committee. That's why we call experts, or a judge. You say, okay, I'm going to talk about how a car works. A judge cannot know what is like. So you call an expert to explain that, and then the judge, but you can't call someone to say something that is within the knowledge of everyone, number one. Two, or about which that person is not qualified as an expert to comment. She knows that. You would never be do this in any proceedings. So I'm just saying, I don't mind, quite frankly, Chair. If you want to waste your time, you can waste your time. But I'm just saying that those answers are worth zero or less than zero in the hands of a factual witness. In the hands of an expert, yes, they are. But otherwise, I mean, we can just have a chit chat, a taxi rank discussion. We're here for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate Mpofu. I am going to ask you to do what you asked me to do. Exercise patience. I've given that back. I want you to also help me demonstrate that.
Okay.
And for that, I'm going to ask Advocate Bauer to continue.
Hi. So when we talked about painting between the lines and a report of the public protector gets set aside by a court of law, then it may or it may not actually have nothing to do with the merits of what's contained in the report, but a lot more to do with the manner and how that report was put together procedurally. Would you accept that?
Correct.
Now, your tasks at the public protector's office are varied. You do QA reports, you provide legal opinions, you sit in meetings, you draft letters for the public protector, you attend to litigation matters, and you attend meetings amongst a broad scope of legally related responsibilities that you've carried. Would you agree?
Correct.
And you've also been charged with a compilation of a Rule 53 record in many cases. Correct?
Correct.
We'll come to the specifics. I'm just being generally, I'm not saying you're responsible ultimately for all of them, Mr. Stowley. So let me get a caveat to that. And the reason why I'm asking this is, when we as lawyers argue in courts of law, there's always a presumption that the judge knows the law, so we don't tell the judge the law. But this is not a court of law. So this is an inquiry, and you operate within a legal prism within the PP's office, and that's why I've taken you through the basics of the principles under which you operate in the Public Protector's Office. And if there was anything I said that you didn't agree with, then by all means, you're welcome to disagree with me. But when it comes to Rule 53 records, can we agree that it is Rule 53, which we all colloquially refer to throughout these proceedings and have not yet explained to the committee precisely what it means, is that it is a rule of court, right? And it effectively means that every scrap of paper throwing light, however indirectly, on what the proceedings were, both procedurally and evidentially, must be included in what is called a Rule 53 record. And that the public protector was told in terms in the APSA judgment. Correct?
Correct.
And that's a trite proposition of law which preceded the APSA judgment in numerous judgments before that. Would you agree?
Agreed.
And I think in the APSA judgment, I find a very good articulation as to why the Rule 53 record is of such importance. And I'll take a moment to just read the paragraph to you, so that all of us can have an understanding as to what the importance of this is. It's an essential purpose of this obligation is to enable a court to perform its constitutionally entrenched review function. This gives effect to the right of the parties under Section 34 of the Constitution to have justiciable disputes decided in fair public hearings, with all issues being ventilated. It also safeguards parties' ability to enforce their rights under Section 33 of the Constitution to administrative action that is lawful, reasonable, and procedurally fair, and one could read in there the application of principles of legality as well. You would agree with that, right?
Great.
The record was essential to enable the reviewing applicants to understand what occurred during the investigation that led to the impugned remedial action and to equip the court to ensure proper administrative justice in the case. Would you agree with that,
Mr.
Satoli?
Uri?
Now, you have had a working relationship with the public protector for a few years now, correct?
Correct.
Right. And I want to ask your impression on two aspects. And that's my sense from what has come before this committee. And you can comment on it. My sense is that when you receive an instruction from the PP, for example, to do a letter, to attend to a task, and if it doesn't come to her diligently, she sends you a follow-up and says, I gave you an instruction and you haven't yet responded to either her or to Ephraim Kabinda or to a chief of staff. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
I've seen that in numerous correspondence that she does that to you.
Agreed.
Also have a sense that she has a good memory and she knows that when she tells you to do something, she's going to remember that she's told you to do something. Would you agree with that?
Very good memory.
Fine. And here's my third proposition to you. She expects you to work hard and in turn, she works hard with you. Would you agree
correct.
With that?
Very correct.
Okay. Now, I want to come to the CX matter. And just before that, just another proposition. As legal services, you provide EXCO. I think that EXCO is the PP, the DPP, and the CEO with quarterly litigation reports, correct?
Correct.
And your predecessor did that as well?
Yes, I think so.
When I say your predecessors, I mean in the sense, We'll talk about Mr. Nemasisi and Mr. Mshlongo as having, although you overlap with Mr. Mshlongo in part, but let's keep it simple and deal with that, right? And I have found And I've loaded it up, but we're not going to go to the specifics of litigation report. But that's the way in which legal services keeps management abreast of what's going on. Correct?
Correct.
Right. And in the CX matter, you only become involved when you move over to legal services and essentially when the matter is already at the application for leave to appeal stage. Correct?
Correct.
Right. Now I want to take you to a page in the bundle and we're going to be using, just for my colleagues' benefit, a combination of 1111 in bundle F and 107 in bundle F, and Shepa will put them on the screen as we go. The first one I'm going to take you to is to page 2283. And this is a report from Mr. Nemasisi in December 2018 when he's doing reporting still, and he isn't able to make a meeting, and he gives a report back where he says the cost, the first bill of cost in the APSA matter comes in at approximately 3.7 million. That is the cost that you have to pay in a cost order made against you, correct?
Yes.
Right. And then he reports on the Frieder report. He tells you that on matters that you've obtained judgments in your favor, you're recovering 1.9 million. And he tells you what he set down in the first quarter of the following year. Correct?
Yes.
Right. And next week, we will get clearer on what the cost in total would be of the APSA matter, because I don't want you under oath to be committing to something we're not both quite clear on. Right. Now, in paragraph 11 of your affidavit, you became involved at the appeal court stage. Right. And at that stage of the proceedings, you put new evidence before the Constitutional Court, correct?
Yes.
And that evidence didn't serve before the court below that had made a personal cost order against the PP, correct?
Correct.
And you would accept that the costs lie within the discretion of the court presiding. Would you agree with that?
Agreed.
And that as a general principle, appeal courts do not readily interfere in the application of the discretions of courts below on cost orders. Do you agree with that?
Agreed.
And what you were seeking from the Constitutional Court in that matter was precisely an interference with the discretion of the court below. Correct?
In essence, yes.
In a sense. Because the gist of what you went to the Concord for was essentially an appeal on the personal cost order.
Correct.
Would you agree?
Agreed.
And you were not successful, but the Constitutional Court didn't make a personal cost order in the bringing of that appeal against the public protector. Correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, subsequent to that personal cost order, and it's no secret, it's been out in the public domain, an organization stepped in with a proposal for crowdfunding to cover those costs. Correct?
Correct.
And were you instructed...
Can you repeat the last one about the organization getting involved?
An organization, well, maybe I mustn't use the word stepped in, Mr. Satoli. There was a proposal in the public domain of an organization who sought to raise funds independently of the public protector to cover those costs. I'm by no means suggesting that the public protector was involved in the crowdfunding. There was a third party organization that stepped in to do that.
Correct. Yes.
And the Office of the Public Protector obtained a legal opinion in respect of that crowdfunding.
Correct.
Right. And were you instructed to get that legal advice?
Yes, we were.
And who gave you that instruction?
It's the chief of staff. The chief of staff through the PP.
Sorry, Mr. Sotoli, I didn't hear that.
The chief of staff is the one who instructed us to get the legal opinion from advocate Dumisa Ntsebeza.
Right, and did you understand that that instruction came from the chief of staff or from the PP?
He would have obviously conversed it with the PP because he reported directly to the PP and he gets instructions from
the
PP.
Just a pause, Advocate Bauer. Mr. Sotoli, I think you either a bit far from the mic. We want to hear you much clearer than that. If you can just reposition yourself so that we don't miss what you say, because then we're going to be forced to say repeat and so on. Just reposition yourself. Can you come closer so that we can hear you? You're just breaking up.
Chair, I'm very close. I'm almost kissing the camera, but can you hear me now?
No, don't kiss it, but close enough. Maybe it's not a mic, might be something else.
Okay, Chair. Can you hear me now, Chair? I opened
yes.
My
volume.
Then, Chair. I'm not sure.
It's on and off, kind of. Mm-hmm. Don't know what's wrong, but up to so far, you've been very audible. Okay, Advocate Bauer, let's see whether it works.
And Mr. Sotoli, you signed off. Did you sign off on payment for this advice?
Yes.
So it was paid for through the Office of the Public Protector?
Yes.
And this was obtained during 2019?
Yes, if I remember correctly.
I know you don't, you may not have it in front of you, but my notes say August 2019, but I don't think for purposes of this, it's potentially irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
We will deal with the cost of this next week. Now, can I put a hypothetical to you? Could there be a potential perception of bias with the organization that had endeavored to raise this funding to lodge a complaint at the Public Protector's Office? And if that organization was seen to be treated differently or preferentially or better, it's a hypothetical, I'm not suggesting that that's what's happening, right? Would that be problematic to the Office of the Public Protector?
I'm not sure. If I get you correctly.
Let me give you an example that's maybe simplistic. Here's an organization that raises the funds that covers the public protector's personal costs, right? And there's a line of 50 people who's waiting to get into the Office of the Public Protector, and they at number 49, and they get taken out of the queue and they get put at number one. Would that be problematic for the Office of the Public Protector to do?
Yes, hypothetically.
Hypothetically?
Yes.
Now, you described your involvement in the Frieda matter in your affidavits from paragraph 12 onwards, right?
Yes.
Now, would it be fair to say that at best your involvement was peripheral?
Yes.
We're not talking about the litigation, we're talking about the
investigation. Yes.
In the investigations and the quality assurance.
Yes.
Right? And you attended the task team meetings and the think tank meetings that occurred during that period. Correct?
Correct.
Right. And you were present at the meeting in August of 2017 when Ms. Saliers presented the update on the matter and the draft final report. Correct?
Correct.
And you would know that there were think tank minutes and there were task team meetings many times during that period. Correct?
Correct.
Now, there is nothing in the Rule 53 record, Mr. Sotoli, about the Gupta leaks. Would you agree on that?
Agreed.
And are you familiar with an auto report? At that stage?
What is it?
An auto report. A
report
provided to the Office of the Public Protector by auto.
No, not to my recollection.
Okay, let me take you to bundle H, number 19. You will see in July of 2018, I think it's July of 2018. 17. Yeah. I'm told I mustn't pressurize the operator behind me. Sorry. Go up, Sipo. I just want to get the date of the WhatsApp. Up, no, all the way up. Yeah. On the 13th of July, the public protector sends off a letter to the CEO. You're not included in this email, Mr. Stowley. And it goes down and she says, follow up with the Free State PR to prepare letters to the Premier MEC and Ms. Sazwani for my signature regards the below Gupta leaks allegations. That is in addition to the Section 7(9) letters issued. Do you know anything about that, Mr. Sotoli?
No.
She then says, I will give you the hard documents submitted by Outer. Have you ever seen hard documents submitted by Outer in the context of this report?
No, not on the Rule 53 especially. Or on the evidence file, if I may put it that way.
And you were part of the task team that was quality assuring and attending to this report at the end of 2017, correct?
Correct.
You are one of the authors of the memo that is provided at the end of January, correct?
Correct.
And as far as you are aware, were you in possession of this outer report?
Not to my recollection.
Now, in that last period after you've done that memo, you attend a meeting in the PP's boardroom together with Mr. Kakani, Mr. Radani, Advocate Matlawe, Mr. Nemasisi in the first week of February, correct?
Correct.
And you deal with that at paragraph 14 of your affidavit?
Yes.
Can I ask you, do you know of any reason why the report had to be issued on 8th February on that day?
No.
Now, you explain your understanding of what occurred in paragraph 14. Can you tell the committee?
Yes. As far as I recall, I think this was also dealt with previously by Mr. Kekana and Mr. Raidani. But mine is more different than theirs because the purpose of this meeting and the reason why the PP called us to the courtroom was as a result of the comments or issues that Mr. Nemasisi raised in respect of the draft report that we were working on. I can't out of my head recall exactly what those issues were, but mostly or some related to the phrasing of the issue. And then there was also an issue that we could not have changed anything on the draft because that was in the section 7.9. So you can't put something new if it was not canvassed in the section 7.9. The discussion was along those lines.
But you don't remember much of what transpired at that meeting, correct?
Yes. Other than
you were not involved.
And
you were not involved in the finalization of the report later on into that evening, correct?
In the evening, no. We dealt with the report after this meeting. And I can't remember what time it was submitted to the PP thereafter.
Right. And tell me, were you in the meeting with Mr. Mayamani?
No.
Okay. Now, if we turn to the litigation, and you explain in paragraph 17 that generally for the compilation of a Rule 53 record, the investigator would be asked to send the record through to legal services and they would know what they relied on and they would provide it for the compilation of the records, correct?
Correct.
Right. And you accept that that would be the record of decision, the draft reports, the memoranda, and all kinds of other documents.
Correct.
And we've already discussed what the ambit of a Rule 53 record would be about, so I don't want to waste time on that. Right?
Correct.
Now, on the 20th of May, you then get the court declaring in investigating and reporting on the Frieda Dairy project that they effectively set aside the report. Correct?
Correct.
And prior to that, I just want to take you to page 2245. This email is an email which follows on, just go down to the bottom so that we can contextualize it. You get in the heads of arguments from CASAC. That's one of the applicants in the matter before the court, correct?
Correct.
Right. And you see on the 6th of August, it gets sent at 3:00 to the PP. And I'll just go up. And it gets sent to you at the same time, actually. And an hour later, and this is why I said to you that I have no, I put the proposition to you that she attends to matters and she works hard and looks at things that get sent to her, right? An hour later, she has considered the heads of argument and she has told you, just go down a bit, as the legal advisors, what she wants you to consider for purposes of the heads of argument, correct?
Right.
Right. And included in that is some guidelines that she says to you, I investigated the conduct, not the complaint. I cannot just rely on untested media reports, right? Provisional report of Madanzala is a working document which has not standing. Observations are binding the state capture, etc., etc. The investigation was completed. You didn't have the 99-year lease. The DA failed to assist with statements of beneficiaries about the prejudice. And I was acting in good faith. I used my discretion on how I issue reports. Similar process was followed with a lot of reports mentioned and they only uploaded to the website. Was this one of the reports that got uploaded to the website when it was issued? Can you recall?
I can't recall the chair.
Well, it's neither here. And she says nothing is stopping the walks and the NPA from investigating, even though the PP. So the point I'm trying to make is you get guidance. The PP has set views on what she wants put into the heads of argument, correct?
Correct.
And you generally relay those instructions to whichever council is on board to take into account the PP's wishes?
Correct.
Right. Now, in this matter, you were tasked with collating that Rule 53 record, correct?
Correct.
And if you see, and you would agree that everybody knew there were task team and think tank meetings that had taken place.
Correct.
And with hindsight now, Mr. Sitoli, do you accept that that Rule 53 record was incomplete?
Yes, I accept that.
And that you, Mr. Nemasisi, the PP, you all should have known that that Rule 53 record was incomplete. Do you agree?
No, I wouldn't say the PP, but I will say myself, Nemasisi, the task team investigators, Free State, and Ms. Dendo ought to have made sure that the record is complete.
Why are you excluding the PP from that, Mr. Sitoli?
Because I don't think that Rule 53 record, before it was filed, it was sent to the PP.
And if it was sent to the PP, would you change your mind?
I would.
Right, so let's test that for a moment. You provided me with a folder, a subfolder, which was what you took off your computer. It consisted of something like over 50 documents of task team minutes, etc. Correct?
Correct.
And you also provided me with a number of emails, which you said to me specifically related to the compilation of the Rule 53 record, correct?
Correct.
Right. So I want to take you to those emails. And I want to take you to, we had bundle F, item number 115 first, 2467.
Well, we don't see it, Sepo. You got it where? Okay.
So let's go down. You see, are you going down too far? Come back up. You see that on the 12th, Mr. Nemasisi sends it off to Mr. Doe, the public protectors included, Mr. Matupi, who's the, I understand, the second in command in that unit. And yourself is included in a request for records and documents, correct?
Correct.
And there's a request that you get it by the 13th of March, correct?
Correct.
I'm going to take you specifically to 121 in the bundle that you provided to me.
Okay.
Shepo, it's on page 2491. Right. On the 16th of March, Mr. Nemasisi sends an email to the public protector. Good afternoon, PP. Kindly find here with the attached draft index to the Rule 53 records. Mr. Sitoli will populate the pagination as the files have already been paginated. Would you agree, Mr. Sotoli, that the public protector had insight into what was going to be filed as part of the Rule 53 record before it was self-filed?
Yes, the draft index, she had insight to it.
And if she had at any stage wanted to add anything or point out to you that the reports on which the Section 7-9 was based, or the think tank meetings, or the task team meetings, or the report that Erica provided to her, Advocate Celiers provided to her into September, or anything like that that was not included in the Rule 53 record, it would have been obvious. You agree?
Come again.
Let's put it this way. The public protector had been part of the think tank meetings. Would you agree?
Agreed.
The public protector had signed off on the Section 7-9 notice. Correct?
Agreed. Correct.
Section 7-9 notice was included in the Rule 53 bundle. Correct?
Correct.
The only two items of draft reports included in the Rule 53 record was the one dated November 2014 report and the final report. Correct?
Correct.
All of you were well aware that there were all kinds of other reports. Correct?
Correct.
Those were not included. Correct?
Correct.
And the public protector would also, on perusal of this index, be aware that it had not been included.
Correct.
Now, attached to this Rule 53 record is a provisional report that says 2014 report. Where did it come from, Mr. Sotoli?
I don't know. I got it on the file. So that Rule 53 record that was compiled, it comprised of documents that came with the investigation file. So everything that was in that investigation file is what was included in that Rule 53 record.
And you didn't check with anybody as to what the status of that report was, whether it had actually reached nobody, whether it was a first draft, a second draft, a third draft, or anything like that?
No.
Thank you, Advocate Bauer. The status of the meeting now is tea break. We'll take a 15-minute break and back at
recording stopped. Recording stopped.
work. Advocate Bauer, back to you.
Mr. Satoli, that report that you found in the file, do you know how it got characterized as a Madinzala provisional report?
No.
And now, when it came to the litigation of this matter, the counsel who was initially on brief was replaced in order that the same counsel who acted in the APSA matter and the Frieda matter take on both matters, because the issue in both instances was a question of personal cost orders. Correct?
Correct.
And that was regarded as a cost-saving mechanism to have the same counsel deal with the same issue, essentially in two different cases.
Correct.
But then there were two matters. One that had been brought by the Democratic Alliance and one that had been brought by CASAC. And when it came to the heads of argument stage of the proceedings, you then had two teams of a council. One appointed to CASAC, one appointed to the DA matter, and they compiled separate heads of argument and they appeared in court to essentially argue separately but together the same case. Correct?
Correct.
Now, why was that done, Mr.
Sotoli? Firstly, there was a request from Advocate Nalwana at that stage of filing his, where he said that it may be quite difficult for him to deal with both matters, and he preferred that we get another silk to deal with KSEC, and then he can deal with the DA application. And to the best of my recollection, that request came at the stage of the filing of the heads. And therefore, we agreed to engage Anthony Platt, SC, to deal with the CASAC heads and appearance.
And if one has a look at the judgment, apart from any of the other factors, you will recall in one of the issues that arose in the Frieda Dairy matter was financial constraints as being a reason, being one of the reasons why certain aspects of the investigation could not be conducted. Correct?
Correct.
As explained in the report, and in fact, Advocate Ongawana SC indicated to you inter alia, amongst other things, that full explanation would need to be put before the court as to what those financial constraints would be.
Correct.
Correct? Right. And so if you look at the judgments in paragraph 29 and 30, one of the factors, and I say one of the factors because it's quite clear from the judgment that there were other factors as well, that the court took into consideration when considering the appropriate cost order to make, was precisely this use of two different sets of counsel in the context of an office who was claiming to have financial constraints, correct?
Correct.
And so the court said there were two applications, two different entities that were based on exactly the same facts and dealt with the same project and relied on the same legal principles. One set of any of a very competent legal teams could easily have dealt with both matters. In argument, the decisions to appoint two legal teams were defended on the basis that two applications served before court. There was no merit in this argument for reasons already alluded to. Those decisions by the public protector unfortunately shows a total disregard for the taxpayer who will have to foot the bill and flies in the face of her complaint about how financial constraints limited her ability to properly investigate the complaints. You see that?
Yes.
So effectively, it was one of the decisions that had been taken to have two sets of counsel that contributed to the findings of the court in relation hereto. Correct?
Correct.
Now, at page 2293, you inform the public protector of the Vrede judgment after it was handed down. Correct?
Correct.
Go down to the bottom. Right. And I don't necessarily want to take you through the email, Mr. Satoli, but you were really disappointed when the judgment came down, correct?
Correct.
And you laid the blame at the doors of the court for the judgment at the time, correct?
Correct.
Don't go up. No, we don't need to go up. I just want to deal with it. Looking back on it now, years later, would you agree you didn't put a proper Rule 53 record before this court? That there may very well have been merit in some of the court's findings in respect of this judgment. Can I have your comment on that?
Yes. My comment in respect of the record, yes, we ought to have put the complete record before court. And as I previously stated, I don't think it would be fair to say the PP should have done that. We should have done that as an investigation team. And maybe to preface my involvement in respect of the record, I joined the institution in May 2017, and we filed the record in February 2018, which is about 6 months later. So I think those who were there for me ought to have known fully which other documents should have formed part of the record. And as I stated in my affidavit, I was involved at the tail end of the investigation, if not at the end of the investigation, because the task team was not necessarily appointed to finalize the investigation, but merely to finalize the report. I think there was an instance where we only needed to get a few more documents from the department or whatever. But my involvement in that investigation was definitely at the tail end. And even when I compiled the report, which was before I went to legal services, I would not have known which other documents are missing. And in respect of the report, as you indicated, SC, the 2014 report was on the court file. The Section 79 was on the court file and all other documents that were there. If we were to include all draft reports, there's been too many back and forth. That means we should have included the drafts that even predated the PP in that Rule 53 record. And I will not have known about those drafts. So that's why I'm saying if anyone must take responsibility for this, it's myself and the investigation team and legal services. Because for me, we should have made sure that we include things that even related to the time of Advocate Matonsela. And if maybe you want me to comment further on the issue of cost, the employment of two sets of silk, for me, I think the court was unfair on us in that. We probably would have spent the same amount because Advocate Ngalona would have prepared heads for DA and CASAC and charged for both. And he would have argued both matters for same time because I think if I remember at the hearing, they split hours between themselves, I think 2 hours. And in any event, SC, if you are requested by a senior counsel to add another senior counsel because he feels he needs to focus on the allegations that are raised by one party and he wants someone else to assist with the allegations that are raised by another party. At that stage of litigation, which is the filing of the heads, you are at the tail end of litigation. You don't want to run the risk of then the same senior counsel coming and saying, I can't file heads for KSEC because I was preoccupied with the DA heads. We might have been wrong in employing both two sets of counsel, but I think it was a bit unfair to criticize us for having employed both sets of counsel. And in any event, the issue of cost is the discretion of the court, such that even if we had won in opposing that a review application, the court would have simply granted cost for one set of counsel. So for me, that is my view on that aspect of the cost finding.
Except that your own client cost would become much higher because you've got two sets of counsel. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
All right. Now, but that wasn't primarily one of your gripes with the judgment. If you go back to the email, you imputed bias on the court in respect of the judgment that was written over and above the legal principles. Stop. Right. Go down. You send off an email to a number of them and you express disappointment in the judgment, express disappointment in the judge, and you impute bias on the part of the judge writing this judgment. Did you have a particular reason for imputing bias on the part of the judge?
No, not really, other than what some of the things that were stated in the judgment. For me, the judgment was more personal than it was a discharge of justice.
Okay, you just faded there. Please repeat.
On which part, Chair?
Just what you have said.
The last sentence faded, Mr. Sotoli.
I was saying that for me, some of the things that were stated by the judge were more personal to the PP than they were to the discharge of justice. At that stage, I was of the view that the judge was biased against the PP.
And you concluded that the full bench would not arrive at a different conclusion.
That was my view.
Right. And you wanted the PP's director so that you could instruct the attorney to file a notice of appeal by the next day, if possible, correct?
Yes.
Now, if we go up further in the email, you say that the judge considered the differences between the provisional report and the final report, correct?
Yeah, correct.
You then what page are we on, Shepard? 2-2? Okay, go to 2295. All right. You then have a debate amongst yourselves about drawing an analogy between a provisional report that has no legal status and a final report by drawing an analogy between a draft judgment and a final judgment, correct?
Correct.
And then the day after the judgment on the 21st, go to 2214. You send off an email to Ms. Hilliers, 2214. It might be on the other. I'm not sure. 2214. Let's just see where it starts. I think it's the first one on the second bundle. Right. You send off an email on the day after the judgment, right?
Yes.
Just go down. And you ask Ms. Hilliers, Erica, is there no provisional report of November 2014?
Yes.
You see that?
Yes.
And that is because of the provisional report Are you asking for a provisional report that had been signed?
Yes.
Right. And you expected one that would be signed by Ms. Madanzala as opposed to one that wasn't signed, correct?
Correct.
Right. Go up. And Mr. Leers' response to you is the following. None that I have. I drafted the provisional report during November, December 2014, together with the letters. They were initially sent to the TT Secretariat, that's the Think Tank Secretariat, Soretta Fente in November 2014, to check if we were on the right path. Can I just pause there for a moment? For all you know, the one you found in the file could have been that one, correct?
Yes, but here I was asking for a signed report.
Right. She then tells you, the first provisional official report for the think tank was submitted on 6 February 2015. Certain revisions were suggested by Ms. Fenter, and then it was resubmitted a couple of days later. Correct?
Correct.
The report served before the think tank on 14th April 2015, and they suggested revisions. This was done and submitted on 28th April 2015 with a revised Section 79 and discretionary notices. So effectively, you know the day after the judgment. That what you've put up in the Rule 53 record before the court was not correct. Is that not so, Mr. Satali?
Correct, SC, and I've already explained my position in respect of that. And actually, this email supplements what I was saying by that. I will not have known that there's a report that was sent to Ms. Soretta Fender in 2014. I will not have known about the minutes of the think tank of February 2015. That is way before my time. And when I compiled the record, it was on the basis that I was part of the task team that was tasked to finalize the report on Friday. So still, it goes back to me saying, even if there is incompleteness of the record, as I concede, it cannot be at the door of the PP. It should be at our door.
No, Mr. Satali, that may well be so. But when the PP comes into office in October 2016, we've had Mr. Chiwalula, I think. His evidence was that he had provided the PP with a stick of all the reports that had been left behind by Advocate Madanzala. Were you aware of that?
No.
And would you agree that that report that was left behind by Ms. Madanzala that was given to the PP should probably have found its way into the Rule 53 record?
Now I agree, because my thinking was that the one that formed part of the record was Ms. Madanzala's, Advocate Madanzala's report.
And this conversation that you're having with Ms. Saliers on the 21st of May 2019 should probably have been had before the Rule 53 record was filed.
Correct. Correct.
And you're now a little bit older and wiser, and you know a bit more than what you did in 2017, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yes, I look at both.
Yes, thank you, sir. So, I feel left out here. I'm none the wiser, or even older. I just want to state the following, sir. The material that is covered with this witness goes far, far, far beyond the issues that are covered in his statement or annexures. My issue really is this. Obviously, Advocate Bauer is entitled to deal with any documents that are part of the bundle that have been uploaded, because theoretically we've all looked at them. But what she cannot do is to canvass documentary evidence in the kind of details he's going into, which is not A, canvassed in the statement, or B, part of the annexures to this witness. Because the whole purpose of the rule that says we must be given a statement 7 days before the witness comes here is to assist us in preparation for that witness. For the record, Chair, we have not enforced the 7-day rule because we want this process to move as possible. And therefore, for example, this statement of this witness, I think we got 2 or 3 days ago, but that's an arrangement between us and the evidence leaders where we have not been fastidious about adherence to the 7-day rule. But in fact, the objection I'm raising would have applied even if we had been given the statement 100 days ago. The point is that the intention of that rule is to allow for preparation. Now, if we're going to be misled, and I don't mean that in a negative way, into preparing for particular issues that are raised in the statement and the, for example, on this Friday matter, Chair, if you could, it's covered in the statement in section B. And really none of these issues about briefing two sets of counsel and all sorts of things are raised there. And I'm not saying those issues are not relevant. I'm simply saying we have not been placed in a situation where we can prepare for them in respect of this witness. And therefore, Chair, I don't want to interrupt the examination of the witness or to stop it, but I'm just saying that if it goes like this, we may not be in a position to cross-examine this witness today because we would want to exercise our right when we now know exactly what it is that has been covered with him to prepare for his cross-examination. I think that would be the worst case implication. Obviously, we'll try to avoid that, but I just think that I must raise it as early as possible as a possibility. Thanks.
Thank you, Advocate.
Yes, there are issues that's going to be transversed to the witnesses that goes in beyond that. I accept that. The documentation has been provided to them prior to this, and part of the reason for that is an endeavor to run a process, do affidavits, and provide documentation. The underlying documentation was provided prior to the affidavits was given to do that. And I think, Chair, if at the end of my direct, Mr. Mpofu feels that there's issues that he cannot cover in cross, I have indicated that Mr. Sipali will be back next week with Mr. Fundamental. I don't have issues if that's how Mr. Mpofu wants to deal with it in that regard. I accept that the affidavit deals with it in general terms, the underlying documentation. In fact, I pointed out to them where the documentation was in that regard. And as I got them while we were busy, we uploaded it. So there are going to be those things. And I suggest that in practical terms, we deal with it on that basis.
Okay. Yes. Chuck, can I respond? Thank you very much. Yes. No, I appreciate that. And I have a proposed solution in mind. But let me just start by saying that to the statement of this witness, there are literally 5 or 6 annexures, and none of them, quite frankly, have been referred to now, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, exactly. So according to my learned friend, we're not there yet. So we've now got something like 10 other annexures that where we are there with, which are not part of this, and in respect of which we have not prepared or conversed with the public protector or any other witness. So what I would propose, Chair, then, is maybe to take advantage of the of the intention to recall the witness is that now that is that my learned friend does go through with her examination in chief, we will try to identify those documents that she refers to, and then maybe if you are inclined to grant, which I'm sure you are, to grant the recall of the witness, that then he only gets cross-examined after he has given his second installment. Because otherwise, in any event, it would be a waste of time to do it now and do it again next week. In that way, I think we can kill two birds with one stone, because then we will cure the preparation gap and at the same time not interrupt and the examination in chief now. The reality of the matter, Chair, is that surely the idea is not that, I mean, we have, this is a big inquiry which with thousands and thousands of pages, I don't even know how many of documents. And I don't think anybody in their right mind can suggest that every time there's going to be a witness here, we must read all 10,000 pages just in case something gets referred to. The idea is to narrow it to a particular witness.
We're not going to change course now. You're going to have to do your leading of evidence up until after lunch. You would have made the suggestion that you will pick up those issues where what would concern in terms of those references, because the witness is coming back next Thursday, but for a different action. So it's going to be important that even both the members today and yourself would deal with some of those issues that are relevant to what would have been placed here today. So there's no problem about the witness coming back. We have that. So I want us to continue, Advocate Bauer.
Sorry, I don't interrupt again. Chair, I think we are misunderstanding what
I got it very clear.
Okay.
I'm just not accepting that we hold back on cross-examination altogether.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That's fine. Enough. But I'm certainly not in a position to cross-examine on the new material that I didn't know was going to be canvassed. But if you want two cross-examinations, that's fine. That's your prerogative. Thanks, Chair.
Advocate Bauer.
I've forgotten where we were at, Mr. Mpofu. Thank you.
We were at wherever that is not in the statement.
I was canvassing with you that after the judgment was handed down, you were well aware that what had been put before the High Court was not correct in terms of the Rule 53 record. Correct?
Sorry, I was muted, was not complete.
You in the course of that litigation proceedings, received advice from Advocate Ongwana, correct?
Correct.
And included in that advice, he advised that if there was anything in the Rule 53 record that had been omitted, it needed to be supplemented with an explanation.
Correct.
And do you have any doubt that Advocate Mkabane would have read that opinion that had been provided by Advocate Ongwana?
Do I have any doubt to that?
Well, would Advocate, let me put it to you positively, would Advocate Mkabane have had regard to the advice rendered by Advocate Ongwana?
Yes.
You then take the Freire judgment on appeal to the SCA, correct?
Correct.
And the leave to appeal is refused. Correct?
Correct.
Now, if you go to page 2294 of the emails, on the day just before on the day just before or on the day judgment comes down, you also get a judgment in your favor in an application to the compel was being dismissed with costs, correct?
Correct.
What matter was that?
I think this was the PP's application for a declaratory order against Advocate Breitenbach and a few other members of the DA.
Okay, that is what's commonly referred to as the defamation matter.
Correct.
All right. Now, that matter started before you came into the legal services office, correct?
Correct.
Can you tell me what relief is being sought in that matter?
It was a relief for a retraction of statements made at the press conference, statements which suggested that PP was on the payroll of a state security agency. And also in the relief, another relief sought was that such retraction must be made in the same press conference where the line of retraction was put in the relief to the effect that the statement they made was wrong, that the PP is on the payroll of status A, a state security agency. In a nutshell, that was the relief sought there.
And that relates to a statement that was made before or after she was appointed as the PP?
As far as I recall, it was before she was appointed. I think it was after Parliament recommended her appointment, if I remember correctly. I can't state it factually.
And what's the status of that matter?
It has since been withdrawn by the office.
Sorry, Mr. Satoli, you faded again.
Can you hear me now, Esti?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the office withdrew that matter.
They withdrew it when?
Recently. I think recently we withdrew that matter. Perhaps Nils can assist me when we come back, just to get those facts right. But in terms of the status itself, the merits were never argued in court. What was before court throughout this time was the interlocutory application that was launched by the DA in terms of Rule 3512, where they sought to compel PP to disclose some of the documents relating to her employment at the state security and I think when she was overseas.
And was this the only action for defamation against those kinds of allegations brought against the PP that was taken up?
The only one I know of, yes.
Now, if we go to paragraph 35 in your affidavit, you refer to the withdrawal of cases, correct?
Correct.
Can you maybe explain how that came about?
I think it came about as a result of financial constraints. I think this was soon after I joined legal services, but I do remember that it was as a result of financial constraints that the PP took the decision to withdraw some of the matters that were pending.
And the instruction that was given is a withdrawal initially of opposition as a result of financial constraints being experienced, and that the office would reserve its rights to fully participate in the proceedings and provide affidavits when necessary. That was the initial.
So you have to correct that. I missed you for like 3 seconds.
Okay. So if you look at the affidavit, there was initially an instruction that you must withdraw the opposition because of financial constraints at the time being by the PPSA, but that the PPSA would reserve its rights to fully participate in the proceedings and would deliver an explanatory affidavit.
Correct.
If it was regarded as necessary in the adjudication.
Correct. Correct.
Now, if I take you to TM6, which is 4059, instruction got amended, and what went out to attorneys was you were instructed to negotiate with the applicant's attorneys by indicating to them that due to financial constraints, the PPSA intended to withdraw its opposition on condition it was not liable for costs. Correct?
Correct.
And if the applicants accepted the proposal, then a notice of withdrawal would have been served.
Correct.
Right. And you would have then provided such a notice to them. And what then? You would effectively close your file on the matter. Correct?
Correct. Correct.
Now, if you look at 4056. These was the list of judicial review matters. I think which had been the subject matter of the withdrawal instruction, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, it subsequently, you go down, Sepo. Number one was shall we call them a Matansala report, correct?
Correct.
Number two was a Matansala report, correct?
Correct.
Number three was emanating from the state capture report, was also a Matansala report, correct?
Correct.
In fact, is that the same Mr. Zwani that is involved in the Vrede matter, the erstwhile MEC of Agriculture?
I think it's the same one.
I think. Right. Number four was the South African Bureau of Standards. That matter actually proceeded at high court level, but there was a decision not to take it on appeal because of costs. Correct?
Correct.
Number five was the Matansala report. Correct?
Correct.
What was the instruction in respect of, well, 6, 7, and 8? Can you tell us? Those were not Matansala reports. Correct?
Yes, correct.
And what was your instruction in respect of 6, 7, and 8?
The instruction on this was the withdrawal, but I think we changed to continue opposition. I can't remember on which one between 6 and 7 already had a date of the hearing. But eventually, we continued with the opposition of these matters. I just can't remember the circumstances under which we did so.
You will recall, those matters were proceeded with, correct?
Correct.
Right, let's go down. And in fact, those matters were also proceeded with, correct?
Correct.
Go down. Go back to 11 and 12. I think there's a clarification. Mr. Sotoli, I think you indicated that numbers 11 and 12 was the...
The 10 and 11, Chair.
Oh, sorry, I'm going back. I'm sorry, Mr. Sotoli. It was very late last night.
Okay.
Go up. Number 10 and 11 is the same, essentially
yes,
the same report. Correct?
Correct. Correct.
Let me just see on what page we're on, Sepo. 40. Just go to 40056. 56. Go up. Sorry, now the other direction. Go up. Go further up. You will see that the instruction there, go down, sorry.
Yeah.
There was an instruction not to withdraw on those matters. Correct?
Yes. Correct.
Just to do that. Now, if you go... to page 2264... If you go down, this is the matter, sorry, the print wasn't very good, but this was the Municipal Workers Union, was also intertwined with another matter, and the recommendation was that it couldn't actually be withdrawn,
yeah,
or both matters had to be withdrawn, correct?
Correct.
So would it be fair to say, Mr. Sotoli, that effectively... it was a qualified instruction to withdraw matters. You didn't withdraw matters in respect of all matters that were not set down.
Correct. Let's see if maybe SC can contextualize qualify.
So essentially, if you had, essentially what you had withdrawn on at that stage was the first five matters on the list.
Yes.
And can I be fair and not be seen that I'm misrepresenting it? There are other matters that come later that you take decisions on that you do not oppose. Correct?
Correct.
And if you go to 2291... 2219. This is the matter of the Johannesburg Roads Agency. In this was one of the matters that you didn't oppose. That came later, correct?
Correct.
And in fact, the complainant end up opposing it and defending your report.
Correct.
Do you recall that?
Yes.
Ended up with the report being set aside and the public protector's office having to pay the cost of it.
Correct.
And the complainant got the cost order against it as well. Oh, no, sorry, the complainant.
No.
The complainant was not lumped with costs.
Yeah.
Do you know what informed the decisions as to what was to be withdrawn and what was not to be withdrawn?
I'm not sure if I follow SC. Is SC referring to the reasons for withdrawal, such as financial constraints and matters where there is no set down?
No.
Because this decision...
let's assume for purposes of my argument, there are 10 matters that are not set down. And you opt for 5 to be withdrawn and 5 not to be withdrawn. What is the decision that informs which ones you don't withdraw and which ones you do withdraw?
I think I'll be expressing a view, SC, but I think it depended on how far the matter is in terms of litigation. If the matter was towards finalization, you were less likely to withdraw opposition. And if maybe I'm to compare withdrawal and non-opposition. The JRA review application, it's one of those that came with others where we decided not to oppose and not to withdraw per se. And our reason was solely on the basis of financial constraints. So it was not a one-size-fits-all decision that it doesn't matter who you are, we are just not going to oppose, or we are going to oppose. So there were variant reasons for that. And hopefully, maybe you'll have Nemesis to come and amplify, because at that time, I was viewing that unit, I was assisting him, but I'm ready to give explanation where I remember.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Sotoli. We're grateful that you're able to do that. Your willingness is appreciated. If we take you to 2292, over and above the list of existing matters, you also embarked on new litigation. Correct? So, for example, in the Minister of Finance PPSA matter, applications get launched and you make a call as to which matters to litigate. It's not like you're standing entirely still on the litigation front.
Correct.
The point I'm trying to make is that financial constraints didn't curb all litigation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree, and I will want to qualify that, SC. I know you might want to take me to task on that. But mostly, Chairperson, financial decisions of a public institution, as you will know, are considered on a financial year basis. So in a financial year, which starts at the 1st of April and ends at the end of March, you will have, let's say you get a review, Chairperson, that is filed in November of a specific financial year. And then by the time you get to the new financial year, then you have new budget, then you can take a decision to say, this matter we decided to not oppose, but now because we have funds in the new financial year, we oppose. And I'm happy, Chair and SC, to speak on the financial arrangements of a specific financial year. That's why there's sort of, it will seem like you had spent a lot of money on litigation, but when you look at it, some of the litigation has spanned the period of 3 years. So you'll find that you spent about 3 million in 3 years, but it will appear as if you spent 3 million in one matter, as if that matter came this month and it was finalized this month. So that arrangement is important, SC. But I'm happy to deal with it next week when we deal with finances. But I was just amplifying as to why you'll have some matters that you are not opposing now, and then it later transpires that you actually did oppose that matter. And I think there are a few of these matters in which the same approach we took.
That's fine, Mr. Sotoli. Thank you. I want to take you to the question of the selection of attorneys that we touch on in your report. There is a panel of attorneys that is appointed, correct? I think you'll see it at bundle I-5534 and 5542. You established a panel in 2018 of 38 persons, and you then attorneys firms, and in 2020 that panel was revised to 18 different attorneys firms, correct? I'm going to show you the panel because
I didn't. I'm not, yeah, maybe if you flight it, SC.
Yes, let's flight it. Let me just think about this. Uh, Mr. Sotoli, we're going to leave it at there. I'm going to show it you over the lunch adjournment. We didn't take telephone numbers off it. Well, let's see if it can go up without the telephone numbers appearing on the list. Let's just give it a minute. But while we're busy doing that, you effectively put out a supply chain management process. See? Okay, so take the if you go down, Mr. Sotoli, that's your 20 list, and I counted about 18 law firms on it. Would that be about right?
Yes. And see, if you look at bid number, the first column, it's the bid number of the tenderer. So it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. But you are correct that in total there were 18 firms, if not more.
Right. And you make this list if you scored more than 70 points, correct?
Correct.
Right. And the previous list of 2018, which is also there, you see a list of 38 law firms on it. Do you recall that? Do you need us to put it up?
I think I recall that.
Okay. Fine. Now, you must appoint an attorney that's on the panel, correct?
Correct.
You can take it off, Shepard. And who selects the attorney's firm?
It's us. Legal services.
Correct. Does the PP have any input into who's appointed?
No, not really.
How do you decide which attorneys to brief?
It depends on the matter, SC, but the unfortunate part for us is that unlike in other SCM processes where you will request a quote and then get the cheapest person, we have rates, and people who accept our rates, then it means there is no need for you to get a quotation from three attorneys who will do the matter cheap for you when they've already agreed to the our fee structure. Therefore, we use our discretion on who to appoint, and the considerations vary from firm to firm, such as whether the firm has dealt with a matter like this before, such as whether there are matters of the same issues, which will then be convenient to be dealt with by a specific firm. So there's no also on this one size fit all for the firms that are appointed.
Right. And so if we go to, I just wanted to put up I think it's 4035, which is a copy. You then conclude a written agreement with whoever you conclude a contract.
Correct.
We had a pro forma at 4035. It's attached to Mr. Stoli's affidavit. We have a pro forma just behind one. We hadn't intended to do that. Mr. Sotoli had indicated that. And in this appointment letter, you essentially confirm the matter they appointed for. Your instruction to oppose and to brief counsel and counsel is usually determined by the PP, correct?
Correct.
Right. And the ultimate say on which counsel to brief is determined, is decided by the PP.
Correct.
Right. And you generally let the senior counsel determine who they want as a junior to work with them in most instances.
Yeah.
Right. And if you go down in your pro forma letter, you advise of the appointment, there must be a written acceptance and go down. The tariff applies and you expect them to exercise reasonable professional skill, care, and diligence. Correct?
Correct.
And you then have a system of payment where the legal services department, the end user department, confirms the deliverables, and then payment is effected through the PP office. Correct?
Correct.
I think you set that out in your affidavit. And if there's non-compliance with the agreement or the tariffs, then you're not able to process. Would that be correct?
Yes, if there's an issue that we can't resolve with the service provider, then we wouldn't process that payment.
And is the system similar when you appoint consultants?
No, because we don't have consultants panel, so to speak. Well, we have now, but it's a panel of experts, not necessarily consultants, but you will find consultants in the expertise industry. You will also find consultants in the legal profession also. But we don't have a panel that specifically says these are consultants that we will only appoint to render a specific service.
And when you appoint counsel, do you know what criteria is looked at for purposes of appointing counsel?
Yeah, usually the first will be seniority, and then the specific expertise in that specific field. For example, if it's administrative law, you want someone who's done administrative law. If it's contract, you want a commercial orientated SC. So the criteria is basically that how good you are in that field.
And you either brief counsel for purposes of legal advice or purposes of conducting litigation, correct?
Correct.
Can I take you to 2299? Shepo must just check if that page is, his details are omitted. Is that okay? I think it's an email, eh? Yeah. All right. Effectively, there's a matter of Mostert, and I just wanted to do this by way of example. This is January 2019. And you tell the attorneys who your preferred counsel is, and if they're not available, who else to brief. Correct? And who would you have gotten that instruction from? I think it's 2297. Go down. PP inquires who the attorneys are, and you then later indicate who the counsel is. Who would that information on the counsel have come to you from? Who would have told you which counsel to brief?
It would have been the PP.
Now, I'm going to take you to some invoices that I canvassed with you. Which is to be found in bundle F at 125. Item 125. If we go down,
go further down. Down, down, down. Right. We see there that's 3rd June, that's slowly into the start of the financial year. If we just see the heading as to what the appointment is for, and we say it's offered to appoint to act on behalf of the public protector in the provision of a legal opinion from senior counsel. Was that the instruction given, Mr. Satali?
Yes.
What does that mean?
I'm not sure if I follow SC by what does that mean. You
explain
mean,
to us what you understand by that phrase.
Offer to appoint to act on behalf of PP. It's an instruction to an attorney to appoint counsel to settle an opinion.
So it's an instruction to appoint a senior counsel to provide a legal opinion.
Yes.
Was that done, Mr. Satali?
Yes, if there's an invoice, and then it was done.
Okay, so let's go down. Just go to the 4th entry. Hold on. Go back up. If we look at the details of the opinion, it says on the 10th of the 4th, 19, perusal of draft opinion from Mr. Ngubeni made amendments and sent it to him. Who's Mr. Ngubeni, Mr. Satali?
Advocate Ngubeni, it's an advocate we briefed to provide opinions for us on, I think, 3 or 2 matters, if I'm not mistaken.
Is he a senior counsel?
No, not to my knowledge.
So there's an opinion provided. Let's just go down. I'll stop for a minute. The opinion comes in to the attorney's firm at the 11th of the 4th, and they received the revised opinion, perusal and consideration, redrafted the opinion and forward same to kind. Do you see that?
Yes.
Do you recall what opinion this was?
I'm not sure from the invoices here unless we scroll down to see the actual opinion.
I'll take you to it in a moment. I just want to, let's go through the train of this and then we'll go to it. Can you just flag for a moment the date of the 11th of April 2019? Do you see that? Just bear that in mind. Let's just go down, Shepo. Go down. Stop there, go down. That's the invoice that's provided in respect of the service that's rendered by Paul M. Ngubeni, correct?
Okay.
It doesn't on that letter, it says he's an advocate. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Go down. Go further down. You signed off on this, correct, Mr. Satali?
Correct.
Go down. Go further down. Go down. Stop there. It says legal opinion on president's investigation. Would you have filled out the GRN?
Yes.
Go up, Shep. Well, let me just explain to them. Just explain to the committee, what is this form?
It's an SCM form for submission of invoices for payment. So it's more like a process that is put in place to confirm a service and payment to the accounting officer.
So you confirm that the service and you confirm the service in order for payment to be made, correct?
Correct.
So you confirm the service, it then goes to SCM and it goes to finance and it then gets paid.
Correct.
Correct? Okay. Go down.
It's his legal opinion on president's investigation. Correct?
Correct.
Go further down. Let's go down. It's signed by you. We see that. Let's go to the next page. There's some duplication in this simply because of the way it's done. Go down further. This is the second invoice. This says this is submission to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. And this is in October 2018. Correct?
Correct.
Right. So we're not near the start of a financial year. We're in that period in which we were having financial trouble and we were drawing all kinds of matters. Correct?
Correct.
Right. So let's go down. Just stop there for a minute. Now, Chippa, you go too quickly. Go back up. Stop there. We see on the 21st of the 7th, perusal of 1st and 19th, the telephone discussion with Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni regarding the email from Mr. Nemasisi. This would have not been in your time, correct, Mr. Sitoli? This would have been with Mr. Nemasisi.
Yeah, but I was already with him at Legal Services in April, in July 2018.
So there you brief Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
And you go down on the 23rd. There's a perusal of relevant legislation and case law. There's discussions with Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni and there's consultations. We go down further. On the 24th, we see a discussion with Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni received and a perusal of a draft legal opinion and documents. You see that?
Correct.
Do you recall obtaining an opinion from Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni in this matter?
I can't recall a thing. I'm sure that's the information I can get.
Right. So when you come back next week, will you have a check and see if you find an opinion that's
yes.
provided from Advocate Mankhe and Mr. Ngubeni?
Correct.
Flag that. Go down. You see there on the 25th, the attorney says amending the legal opinion, conducting further research and finalizing the legal opinion. All right?
Hey.
See that? And these two fees, a consultant's fee for Mr. Ngubeni of 77,500 and a counsel's fee for Advocate Mankhe. You see the distinction in the fee note?
Correct.
Go further down. Can I ask you, would there have been an instruction to the attorneys to engage the consultant and brief the advocate in this instance?
Yes.
Because if there wasn't such an instruction, you would never have paid the fee notes, correct?
Correct.
And where would that instruction have emanated from?
In practice, it would have come from the PP or it would have been suggested by Nemasisi.
Right. So
I don't know.
Down.
It wasn't, for that one, it wasn't sent to me directly.
We then see an instruction. Just go back up. Sorry, I just want to get the date. Right. We see an instruction on the 1st of October, still in 2018, and we instruct to settle a letter for the National Assembly Speaker. Do you see that?
Correct.
Go down. I don't know what this letter is, but it's a 20,000 rand letter. Let's go back down. And we see that payment, go further down, payment of goods received on the 13th of the 12th, Legal Services letter to the National Assembly. Go back down. Whose signature is that?
That's me.
That's you. Okay. Go further down. So you received the deliverable for that, right?
Yes.
The 14th of the 12th, 13th of the 12th, right? Let's
right.
go further down. You then see legal service submission to portfolio committee justice disbursement, 153,000. You see that?
Correct.
Let's go down. You see that on the 13th of December, 2018, you approve payment for that. Correct?
Correct.
Let's go further down. We see the attorney Cienego is paid an amount of 206,000 for submissions to the portfolio committee. Go further down. That's a statement. Let's get to the invoice. We see stop. Let's swing at the date. We see that that date is the 17th of July 2018. Submission to the portfolio committee on justice and correctional services. Correct.
Right.
Just a pause on everything, Advocate Mpofu.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Sorry, I'm sorry. I've been trying not to interrupt, but I wanted to raise this before the lunch break so that it might assist us when we come back. I would like to really know what this is in aid of in relation to the motion, because quite frankly, I'm completely at sea as to what the purpose of this is, particularly because it involves money paid to people and names of people and attorneys and all sorts of things, which I'm sure should not just be done in vain if we're going to disclose people's financial affairs. There must be a good reason. And I just don't know in relation to the motion, I suppose it's a variation of the question I asked earlier, and I was told it was had something to do with Fred and what, and that I understood, but now again, maybe it's just me. I'd like that just to be clarified before we break so that...
I would have liked to finish
that's okay. You will declare. Okay, we'll do that clarity. Please.
Mr. Poffel, we have a defense of financial constraints in the same period in which these expenses are incurred. That's the first thing. The second thing is we have an office of a public protector that must operate independently. And I want to show during this period of time, I'll unfold it as to specifically who is employed during this period for what purpose to do that. And I have specifically picked three invoices. And if you allow me to come to the last one, we'll see this. I would really like to finish this before the lunch adjournment rather than come back.
Yeah.
Okay. Chair, again, none the wiser, but I think for the sake of progress, let it continue.
Okay. Yeah. Proceed. You switch on what you paused.
Right. So we're now in July 2018, and there's consultations happening in respect of the submissions to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. Correct?
Correct.
You just go down. Down. And we now see at this stage in June, July 2018, we have Advocate Paul Ngubeni. Right?
Correct.
And he's a disbursement on the attorney's fee note.
Correct.
Correct. Go down in this regard, stop quickly. And he is billing essentially for traveling, reading, researching, and reading revised letter. There is no other deliverable that he's billing you for. Can you see that?
Correct. You mean except
that's
for item 2, 3, and 4. I'm not sure if I get the deliverables.
Sorry, I'm phrasing that very badly. My apologies, Mr. Sotoli. I had prefaced you early on and I asked you if you received an opinion from Advocate Ngubeni and Mr. Ngubeni, I'm not sure anymore, and the other advocate. And the point I was trying to make is there doesn't seem to be expressly from the invoice that he compiled an opinion. He seemed to be reading papers, reports, correspondence, and reports received, and he does research, and he drafts a response for the public protector, and he reads a revised letter which he responds to. So the only point I was trying to make was it doesn't appear from the fee note that there was an opinion. I didn't want to send you off on a wild goose chase to look for an opinion that might not exist.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Yes.
Do you agree that it doesn't reflect an opinion being provided?
I agree with that you could be wrong, SC. I'm sure that I can find either from the attorney or from our records. But if he was briefed to do an opinion, then there must have been an opinion.
Great. Now let's go down. The advocate, go further down. Go down. He bills for drafting, research and drafting. Doesn't tell us what he's drafting, but he's drafting something. Go down. And he's further drafting, but he doesn't tell us what he's drafting. So do you know what he was drafting, Mr. Sotoli?
No, but the context will lead to an inference of an opinion. I think if we look at the GRN.
Okay, and the GRN says submissions of the portfolio committee. Do you recall that? Shall we go back up? Maybe Shepo should just go back up.
Yeah, because I'm not following. SC, sorry.
No, it's fine, Mr. Sotoli. Stop. Go down. It says legal services submission to Portfolio Committee on Justice Disbursement. You see that? That was the invoice for the disbursement of the fees in relation to the submission to the Portfolio Committee.
Okay.
Go down. Yep. I want to take you to the last invoice. Mr. Sotoli, would there have been a due diligence done on the people who are briefed or the consultant who's engaged? Would you have checked up on them in any way?
Not me.
Would you have known if Mr. Nemasisi would have done that?
Yeah, I think he would have done it.
Okay, go down. It is the letter of the appointment for the preparation of the portfolio committee. In 2018, I think. And I'll just go up to the date, Shepo. 2018, right? In June 2018, there's an appointment made of Cienega attorneys to prepare submissions for the portfolio committee, correct?
Correct.
All right, now go to the next page. All right, go down. You see, there's a legal opinion on Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni.
Correct.
Correct? Are you in possession of that legal opinion, Mr. Sotoli?
Sure, I can get it this thing.
Okay, go down. Did you sign off on this invoice?
Yes. Yes.
Right. And that's in mid-2019, correct?
Correct.
Just go down to the attorney's invoice. That's 3rd June, sorry. I wrote that in because I accidentally deleted the date in preparing the bundle, so I just wrote it back in to do that.
I can see it.
My apologies. If you see the second entry on this, the opinion, or it says Mr. Ngubeni's fee, 87. You see that?
Right.
Right. And so there was an instruction to the attorney in respect of an opinion, Tito Mboweni, correct? And an instruction, presumably, to the attorney to brief Mr. Ngubeni to provide it. Would you agree?
Agreed.
Right. Let's go to Mr. Ngubeni's fee note. Right. Let's just stop there. You get, Mr. Ngubeni says, I received and perused revised draft of public statement from Office of Public Protector. You see that?
Yes.
And then he says draft opinion and advisory on strategy.
Right.
What strategy would that be, Mr. Sotoli?
I'm not aware, unless the opinion is attached to this GRN.
Do you usually attach the opinion to the GRN, Mr. Sotoli?
No, I saw on one you attach them, but on this one, I don't think you have.
No, I right.
You attached
it. Genesis draft, yeah, my apologies, I'm talking across you. Sorry, Mr. Sotoli.
It's okay.
It says draft document Mboweni unconstitutional conduct and utterances in opinion form. Do you see that?
Yes.
Right. Do you know what conduct and utterances is being referred to?
I can't remember, but I'm sure I can be refreshed if SC has some form of documentation on this, other than this invoice. Or probably when I get the actual opinion.
And then it says researched and analyzed renewed political attacks on public protector. The matter of the APSA ruling is on appeal and rules of parliament prohibits a discussion of the same matter pending before the courts, and yet parliamentary committee was scheduled to deliberate on the same matter with a whole lot of articles. Do you see that?
Yes.
Have you got any comment on that?
No, not at this stage.
Okay, go down. There's travels and meetings in Mpumalanga. And then it says, research, draft, and published article in Mboweni's attack on the public protector and judicial review.
Correct.
Go down. It says, research, drafted, and published article on state security minister's attack on public protector.
Okay.
You see that?
Yes.
Would you agree with me that this looks like invoices rendered for purposes of producing articles?
No, to my recollection, Advocate Ngubeni rendered opinions. Legal opinions, that is.
Sorry. It says a research drafted and published article on state security minister's attack on public protector, constitutional mandate of public protector and apartheid era classifications of documents issued, published act, and it gives the website at which that was published.
Okay.
You see that, Mr. Sotoli?
You see that, Esme?
That is not an opinion. That is something that is published on African News 24.
I follow
SC. If you go up. If you go up. You will see that that article, research drafted and published article on Mboweni's attack on public protect and judicial review. And you see the article published at African News 24.
Okay.
Do you see that?
Yes.
And if you go further up again, similarly, look at published articles at those addresses that he looked at.
Okay.
And so I'm saying to you that the way this fee note reflects with the hours spent is that effectively Mr. Ngubane got paid for publishing articles on websites. Do you have any comment on that?
Not really, SC, other than to say, as far as I know, he was engaged to prepare an opinion for us. And I think in item one of his invoice, that's what he states. Perhaps SC can shed light if you want to bring him before the committee.
Go up on the opinion. So received and perused the revised draft of public statements from Office of Public Protector, 1.5 hours. And then he says on the first and the second day, draft opinion and advisory on strategy draft document, Mboweni unconstitutional conduct and utterances in the opinion form, 13 hours. You see that?
See that? Yes.
Fine. So are you saying that that was what he was briefed to do?
Yes. As far as I know.
And is that legal advice?
An opinion will be legal advice, but the rest will not be legal advice.
Is Mr. Ngubane, is this a good time to take the adjournment?
Yes, I'm just about to ask you to pause. We're going to take a lunch break and back at 2. Thank you.
Recording stopped.